Made In, Interior Screenplay Podcast today. Welcome to the first 10 pages. We talk about the screenplays of your favourite movies and some of your least favourite as well. We particularly focus on the part that must hook the reader, the first 10 pages. My name is David Ferrier, my co-host, professional screenwriter, Keir Wilkins. Keir, what have we got today?
Hey Dave, today we have the 1997 comedy Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
I'm going to need you to sign these release forms.
Okay, name, sex, yes please.
In his time, he was the coolest secret agent alive. Unfortunately,
it's freedom, baby, yeah!
This is not his time. Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
Oh, I don't need to have fun, Austin. That's you in a nutshell.
No, this is me in a nutshell. Help! I'm in a nutshell!
And our guests who chose today's screenplay, comedians, podcasters, and more recently, acclaimed investigative journalists for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation with their podcast Finding Drago, and now the follow-up Finding Desperado. It's Alexi Toliopoulos and Cameron James. Fellas, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. Thank you so much.
It's our shagadelic pleasure to be here and share this great movie and moment with you two.
If I could find one word to describe it, I guess the word I'd pick would have to be groovy. It's a groovy experience to be here with you fellas.
Is it horny to be here with us? Are you both, what's your horny level?
We're building up to that. We're building up to horny.
Okay. Yep.
We're sitting at a very comfortable, Randy, but we're moving up to horny.
Yeah. Okay. I pray that we get to horny, but Randy, I will settle for. That's still a good time.
Let's get there together. Kia, I know you're always horny. That's what they say about you.
Always.
fans of your podcast, Alexi and Cameron, podcast work would know that you both absolutely adore Mike Myers. One of your first projects was Mike Check, going through the filmography of Mike Myers. So I would have thought that much Mike Myers exposure might have led to some burnout. But since you've chosen Austin Powers for this, I assume that's not the case.
You never get sick of Mike Myers, I think. If you're a fan, you're a lifelong fan. You're there for So I Married an Axe Murderer all the way through to Shrek the Halls. You can't bow out. What do you think, Alexi?
Yes. I agree. We're Mike's tykes for life. Mm. We are his second generation. We continue Mike's legacy very proudly, and we will continue to burn that horny little can for him.
So your latest project, podcast, Finding Desperado, is a follow-up to the excellent first season, Finding Drago, which is about you two tracking down an obscure Australian author who wrote an even more obscure novel about the life of the bad guy in Rocky IV, Ivan Drago. In Finding Desperado, you're trying to find the man who had the Guinness World Record for being the youngest filmmaker ever, a title that you both believe may be fake.
That's right. That's right.
By the time this episode comes out, the first two will have of new season will have come out. Where does the journey take you both?
It's a globe-trotting one, this one. So our filmmaker, Lord Sidney Ling, that we're trying to track down, he's Dutch. We believe he's Dutch. But I believe by the time this episode is out, we will have learned that he spent a significant amount of time in Ibiza, which is a glorious Spanish island, I believe, or something, Mediterranean island. Where is it?
Is he a Dutch DJ?
It's a Spanish island in the sun that is best known for, like you said, DJ parties. Kevin and Perry Go Large. We almost decided to do that movie for this podcast.
Yeah, oh, my God. Yes.
That is a shame. That is a shame that we're missing that.
I know. It's a shame. My dog is attacking me right now. I don't know if you guys can see in the Zoom window.
But, we can just see your puppy. Yeah. Who's that?
She is attacking me. So if I just start crying, it's because she's bitten my artery.
And well, a little behind the scenes info is that we've got to be done by a certain time because you've got to get her to puppy preschool.
Yeah, and from the looks of it, she's
and
not.
And by the
doing
looks
that.
Of it, she needs it.
Yeah, she's not doing
and Cameron well. Is hey, such a film enough. Lover. He actually named his dog after a movie.
I did. My dog is named.
Can I get?
Junior.
Can we guess? Oh, sorry.
I've already told you. Her name is Junior. Full title of her name is Ivan Reitman's Junior, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
Wonderful.
Is that on the official adoption certificate?
Yes, it is. Full? It is, yes.
Brilliant.
Your love of film and filmmaking is part of the reason you wanted to pursue Finding Desperado. Like, how did that all play into this journey that you went on?
Well, it's I feel like when you're a young kid and you want to be a filmmaker but you don't really know how to get into that world, your entry points are the Guinness World Records and the 1001 Films to See Before You Die book, and if you're a little bit older, the Microsoft Cinemania series, and they're all kind of just like trivia about movies, basically. So I and Alexia as well, we're both kind of obsessed with the movie sections of Guinness Book of Records. And I think to be included in the Guinness Book of Records as a filmmaker is a huge honour. It's a wonderful achievement.
Tremendously so.
More than an Oscar, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's more unique. They only give it out once. Oscar, hundreds of people have Oscars. Very few get the Guinness World Record for world's youngest filmmaker.
They're not handing that out every year.
Is Austin Powers in the Guinness Book of Records at all? Do we know?
Yeah, most uses of the word shagadelic.
Yeah. And it only was usurped twice by Spy Who Shagged Me and Goldmember.
Fantastic.
Didn't they use shagadelic about 38 times in the film The Constant Gardener? I seem to remember Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you do see it pop up in other films for sure, but never at the frequency that Mike uses it in this screenplay.
Okay.
And of course, that movie's set in 1997, so like everyone was using it around then, so it had to make it period accurate.
It was 97. Yeah. A lot of people think Shaggy.
They've just seen it. Huge fans.
So we were kind of a bit obsessed with the fact that potentially someone has fraudulently gotten this amazing achievement of being a Guinness World Record making filmmaker. And we decided to use all the resources available to us by the ABC, which is not many resources, but we used all of them, all of the available not many resources to try and track this guy down and figure out why you would lie. Why would you fake it? What would you get out of it? And why would you spend 30 years trying to hide the truth? And that's what Finding Desperado is.
Like the first season, it has the hook and intrigue of a true crime podcast, because that is essentially what it is. It's a mystery show. Mm. But it is one of those shows where when you like stop to reflect on what the content is and what the mystery is, it's so delightfully ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yes. We love to live in inanities is what we thrive in. It's just absolutely inane mysteries that we are the only ones tracking down.
But what we've noticed is if you put like it's tense spooky music under anything, people get sucked in. People are like, oh God, I hope they figure out who faked this Guinness World Record in 1991.
You refer to yourself in the podcast as pop culture detectives, and I wonder whether you are offering your services outside of podcasting just to people who, because I know people that would pay top dollar, you know, who get something stuck in their head. They're like, no, it was this movie I saw when I was seven, and I just remember this like demonic rabbit, and I just wonder if you guys are offering those services.
Yes, Donnie Darko, definitely. This mystery solved, give me $3,000.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Someone sent me, the most weird one that I had recently, someone sent me a photo of their friend and they said, we're all at dinner and we think our friend looks like a character actor from the 1990s, but we can't figure out which one. And I figured out which one just from looking at a photo of their friend.
Wow.
I was like, it's Zach Grenier from Soda Land. And just sent them a photo of this character actor called Zach Grenier. And everyone was like, oh, thank you. Thank God. We've been talking about it all night.
Adrian Grenier's brother?
Oh, he wishes. We all wish we were brothers with Adrian Grenier.
The two could not look.
Has Kia accidentally just revealed like a spin-off podcast? Because that was, I remember Empire Magazine, that used to be a thing at the front. Some people would write letters for questions, because this was before the internet, of like, I seem to remember this movie from the 40s and it had Santa Claus, and they would track down the answer. Pop culture detectives. with Alexi and Cameron. Coming soon, question mark?
We could pitch this. We could pitch this.
We would love it.
Anyone who will pay for it will sell out to you. We don't mind. We don't mind.
Yeah, Empire, we will do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, of course. Anyone. We don't mind. We just want that money. We want money to justify the amount of hours we've spent watching Mike Myers movies and reading Empire magazine. And Alexi has every edition of 1001 movies to see before you die, so we've got to pay.
Yeah, I think I have like at least 4 or 5 of them, and I'm still paying them off. I still am in debt to Steven Schneider.
How many? Have you counted how many of them you've seen? Hey, can you die yet?
Yeah, I'm close. That's a great question. Close to clocking out, basically. I've got a couple of 1930s movies. I got White Heat left before I pass on from this mortal coil. And yes, the Earth is a coil. Cameron and I are coil earthers.
We're coil earth truthers.
Well, that could be a future project. But in the meantime, you've got Finding Desperado, which is excellent, by the way. Can I just as someone who, you know, my day job is in radio and I'm doing this podcast and stuff. Whoever you've got producing that show and doing the edit does an amazing job.
They're incredible.
It is so beautifully put together that, like, it's got such a wonderful pace and the content is very engaging and very fun and very funny. But the music, like, everything about it is just, like, all the details, all the I's have been dotted and all the T's have been crossed and it just, like, the whole podcast sings.
We're so lucky. Producer Bryce Halliday, mixer and sound designer John Jacobs and music by Luca Barone-Peters. Geniuses, legends. You have no idea how many hours of inane, nattering bullshit they had to wade through to turn it into 35 minutes of content. So we're very lucky to have those. Wonderful.
And I think the other like little magic piece of collaboration is that every single one of them has a completely different sensibility to Cameron and I. So it's like having access to an entire different like person's creativity. And they're all actually all kind of funnier than Cameron and I. So it works out to be really good.
Yeah, that's very true.
What were you going to say, Kia?
I was just going to give a special shout out to whoever thought to put the CD-ROM sound effect when you're going back into the cinema encyclopedia.
All those little touches.
That just hit me right in the nostalgia feels.
Oh, yeah.
Hearing that sound in my headphones, I was like, oh, damn, that's good.
Every time we hear a draft, there's always some crazy new sound effects that he's put in. And every time I go, God damn it, that's so much better than anything we've done. Always
he like really overfills it, so we only have to go like just take that back because he has so many like incredible ideas. Like the only one that I really gave him was like, you have to take that fart sound effect out. Actually a little too far even for us.
That's a little behind the scenes because the fart sound effect did not make the final cut of episode 1, but it was in every previous draft up until very recently.
All right. So listen back to episode 1 and just imagine where might have been. You can insert your own fart sound effect.
I'll give you a clue. And one last thing. I'll give you a clue. It's when we say the word fart.
There's a hint. Listening.
This is why you're a pop culture detective.
Speaking of the detective stuff, you guys do something in season 1 and I was so thrilled that it came back for the first episode of season 2, which should be in every investigative podcast. I don't care how serious it is. There should be a Google montage because that is what everyone does. The first, if you have a question, there's some piece of information you want to know. The first port of call is a website called google.com and you guys make that so entertaining. I just absolutely love it. Was that always there from the start?
I think it was something that just happened in the first season because we wanted a sports montage because it was all about Rocky the first season. And we wanted to include a thrilling montage moment, but the only thing we'd done is sit on Google and Google names and places. Yep. So we tried to make it sound as thrilling as possible. And then it just naturally occurred in the first episode of this. And it's unintentionally become a motif.
Yeah.
Yeah, our trademark is Google montages. Google montages.
A character of the show. Because you can't, like, you know, I feel like other shows trying to be something else would try to hide the fact that it's like that, of course, you Google something. You don't call straight away, go straight to, like, you know, the state library or whatever.
I know. And there's a lot of stuff cut out that we do, that we go, no, we need to show every step of this investigation. So, yes, we Googled for ages.
Yep.
And then we made four calls that went nowhere. And then we blah, blah, blah. And then our producers are like, let's really trim it down. You don't need to show the calls that went nowhere. Just leaving. A Google montage is already a big ask.
You don't need to go show all the emails back and forth where you teed up the interview with the interview subject. We don't need to have all that stuff in the podcast. But we still read them out and get actors to perform them. And it's tragic that what we're saying actually is quite true.
That is true. That is true.
Repeatedly having the same conversation, refining your pitch for, like, telling someone cold what the podcast is about.
That is very true.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's get to the reason why we're here. The screenplay for Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery by Mike Myers. Mm. First, this is the final draft that we all read, dated the 24th of May, 1996. The first 10 pages. There is a lot in the screenplay that didn't make the final film, but we will cover those off. But first, a summary. The first 10 pages of the screenplay introduces us to an initially faceless Dr. Evil, an evil genius who has a high-tech lair somewhere in Nevada. After casually killing several of his employees for incompetence, he announces his desire to kill the only man in the world capable of standing in his way, Austin Powers. We then meet the titular hero in a Technicolor dance number through the streets of swinging 60s London, during which he demonstrates his skills in being irresistible to supermodels, fighting bad guys, and generally charming everyone he meets. He jumps into a convertible where he and his beautiful associate, Mrs. Kensington, are called by Basil Exposition, who explicitly outlines the plot setup for Austin and the audience. The setup is this. Dr. Evil plans to take over the world and is planning a trap for Austin at the Electric Psychedelic Pussycat Swingers Club. That night, at the club, Austin mixes with Mick Jagger, Andy Warhol, the Queen, and Forrest Gump, before he and Dr. Evil have their first encounter, at the end of which Dr. Evil escapes in an egg-shaped capsule labeled cryogenic. He tells Austin Powers he'll see him in the future when free love is dead and greed and avarice once again rule the world. Cut to 1997. Dr. Evil returns, but we find out soon after Dr. Evil froze himself, Austin Powers volunteered to undergo cryogenic freezing in case Dr. Evil ever returned. He is thawed out, ready to take on his nemesis once more, but a lot has changed in the last 30 years, and Austin is going to have to figure out how to navigate the crazy modern world. Hey, Kia, this is a you hear about the guy before you meet the guy set up for Austin Powers.
Yeah, a little cold open.
Which is like an effective, cold open way to set up how cool this guy is.
Yeah, and they kind of have two bites of the apple there as well with not showing you Dr. Evil's face in that opening moment. It's a classic James Bond. It's like, he must be so scary, so terrifying to look at that we're going to hold off his face as a reveal. And in some ways, that is true. It is quite horrifying.
Alexi and Cameron, the first page of this, like, very wacky comedy, on the page, when you read it, it's not funny at all. It's actually quite serious and upsetting.
Yeah, we've talked about this a little bit in the past as well. It's that Mike is such a slavish fan of Bond that this movie, it's the first sort of this opening moment, and a lot of the Dr. Evil moments could almost be 60s era Bond films. They're not even parody to a certain point. It's only funny because it's Mike Myers and Will Ferrell and Mindy Sterling in the parts. But this could be Blofeld.
It really could be, and I think that's, like, what makes this work, is that this script, at least, is, like, it begins so, like in honor of James Bond. Like, it is a very, like, almost like a straight parody, where it's just, like, this is exactly what these characters were like. It's points out that they're kind of silly by having, like, all the henchmen or all, like, the collaborators of Dr. Evil be, like, genuine stereotypes of things that you would consider to be like James Bond villains of that era, being like these like Swedish or Norwegian twins and being like almost like draped in like Nazi and revolutionary insignias and uniform, like very uniformed people. And then it's only kind of like just heightened up by being parody, by having someone being like a literal meter maid, which would be what like a normal person would consider like the evils of their everyday life. And
Frau is wearing a Salvation Army uniform.
Yes, yeah, she's a representative of the militant wing of the Salvation Army.
Which is funny. But this is a James Bond parody, very clearly with Dr. Evil, but Mike Myers, Austin Powers is not a parody of James Bond. No. The character.
No. And you know what? It's a parody of Antonioni's film Blow Up.
Yeah.
And this is a film that Alexi and I had never seen until very recently. And once we finally watched Blow Up, we went, oh my God, it's just, that's the whole movie, is just this opening moment of him in swinging London, being a good photographer, being irresistible to chicks, and wearing velvet jackets and stuff like that. It's crazy. Mm. What a specific and niche parody that it doesn't seem like it should even be married to the James Bond lore.
I think he just like goes, what were things that were like sexy and exciting, or a combination of those words, shagadelic, really, like in 1960s England and 1960s popular culture. So this opening sequence, like we have the Beatles, we have like Andy Warhol, we're introduced to like Austin in this way that is like just showing him as like this over the top, ridiculous pastiche, which is so... like, it's so fun because you do anticipate who can only go up against Dr. Evil? Well, it has to be a very serious James Bond type. But then to immediately be confronted by someone wearing the most, like, over the top, or described as a very over the top, like, Beatles boots, Italian type suit, like, over the top colors, and for it to literally devolve into a dance sequence within 30 seconds or within, like, half a page of introducing us to Austin is, like, a perfect way to undercut everything and show you what the actual movie you're going to watch is going to be like.
Kia, do you think that's part of the hook for these first 10 pages is because it is this pastiche of these colourful archetypes of 60s, swinging 60s colour, and there's all these references, and also, like, it trades on, you have to know who Mike Myers is to know that he could pull it off as well.
Yeah, because I know that, like you say on this show, the first 10 pages is what usually would be used to hook an exec in, or, you know, any kind of funding. To get a go picture, you need to get those first 10 pages singing. I don't know if I was an exec in 1996 and I received this screenplay, I don't know if the first 10 pages alone would cut it for me. I think I'd have to know who Mike was, and I'd probably have to hear the song Soul Bossa Nova by Quincy Jones.
As you read the big print.
Yeah, which is written into the screenplay, and from what I understand was a big key thing for Mike for coming up with the tone and style of this film, was him kind of rediscovering Soul Bossa Nova and improvising a dance sequence around his house, and his wife saying, that's really funny, that should be in the movie. And then him kind of going, oh, maybe I'll just reframe the whole movie around this energy. This crazy, fun, sexy energy.
And I reckon an executive would want to see, if they saw the box office receipts for Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2, they go, oh, okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, right, do whatever you want. Do whatever you want.
Kia, what do you make of it?
The first 10 pages, it's littered with references that are just like from all over the place. He's like, oh, this bit's like just going to be exactly like My Fair Lady, and this bit's going to be like the Thomas Crown Affair, and this bit, and then Forrest Gump intrudes on this. Yeah. Like, he is just grabbing from every... Absolutely. That was a smart cut. The Forrest
Couldn't
Gump
be
thing,
in more agreement with you, Keir. That is, that actually jumped out at me as very uncomfortable to read that Forrest Gump is in this screenplay.
Yeah, Forrest Gump exists in the Austin Powers universe in the screenplay that we read. But yeah, Kia, you're right. It is a very smart cut. They paired it back to just having Andy Warhol there. But even in the screenplay, he exchanges words with Andy Warhol. Mm. Mick Jagger is there. They talk to each other.
Mm.
All smart cuts. That
do you know
that
what?
Just over-egged it.
One thing that I kind of think is if they did include the scene with Mick Jagger, so that happens when they get to the Electric Pussycat Swingers Club. Psychedelic? Is there a psychedelic in there that I missed?
Psychedelic, yeah, somewhere. I think is the first word.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. Sorry, everyone. Sorry, Mike.
Electric Psychedelic Pussycat Swingers Club. There you go.
Thank you. Austin has an interaction with Mick Jagger where he, in a very Forrest Gumpian way, inspires a couple of song lyrics for Jagger. My only regret about never getting to see that is who they could have possibly cast as Mick Jagger. Because you know it would have been someone funny. In my head, it's Chris Kattan from SNL.
Yeah.
That's who I'm seeing.
He does look a bit Jagger-esque, but I believe... Didn't Mike used to do a Mick Jagger impression on SNL?
Oh, did he? Or did he do Ron Wood?
He used to do... Mm. I think he's done both. Ron Wood was the talk show host that he used to play. Who was...
Jimmy Fallon did a Jagger.
But he used to do...
Get a young Jimmy Fallon.
See, but I wonder whether... In Mike's mind, he was like, I might be at the level where I could just get
Yeah, that's
Mick
another
to
thing.
It
could have been a cameo. You know,
there one of my favorite SNL sketches starring Mike Myers is it's an interview with him playing Mick Jagger and then Mick Jagger playing Keith Richards.
Oh, that's that's funny.
So you amazing. Just get him to do that. It's Mike versus Mike. It would be tremendously funny. I was delighted reading that moment, but then when it devolved to going more like, okay, he also introduced the can of soup of Campbell's to freaking Andy Warhol. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is getting a little too Forrest Gumpy. I don't know if I like it. And then the next words that I read were Forrest Gump, but it's just like the scene in Forrest Gump where LBJ gives him a medal. I'm like, oh no, this is too
it
much.
Reads it it's reads so much, much like this was written in 1996, hot off the heels of the massive success of Forrest Gump, and at the time that was a killer reference that would have dated very poorly. Yes. Like there's already something else that dates poorly. But it's funny in itself because it's a bit of physical comedy when Dr. Evil does the Macarena to show his hip. That's dated. But the Forrest Gump thing, I don't think people would even get that reference on rewatching it.
Glad it's gone. But I would have loved to have seen it on an SNL, like if Mike hosted SNL at the time and they did that as a sketch, I'd be happy to see that.
There. Yeah, yeah. And reading those first 10 pages just on whether you would an exec would read them and pick up the movie without knowing Mike Myers, it reads a lot like kids in high school who don't understand that parody isn't just doing bits from your favorite films and recording it on a handy cam. You know, it's not particularly astute, or there's no commentary behind it. It's just like, here's a bunch of things that I like and admire and think are funny, and I'm going to do my version of them with me playing all the roles. It doesn't leap off the page. It's like, this is good comedy. This is champagne stuff.
Big time. And if we want to kind of really go back to the entrance of Austin Powers on page 2, Carnaby Street Day, that whole sequence is, I think, there's too much going on in it for a start. There's a lot of extra stuff here. But I think we have to give props and praise to Jay Roach for actually turning this higgledy-piggledy bunch of references and scenes into an astounding sequence in the final cut of the film. It is so funny and so engaging and energetic and almost wordlessly tells you everything you need to know about Austin just within 2 minutes.
Mm.
But you don't get that on the page.
And it brings like that... It brings that essential, essence of glee that is so prominent to like falling in love with like that impish quality of Austin Powers and falling for that character, and doing it wordlessly is brilliant. I think it is also testament to like Mike Myers growing as a creative, because on Wayne's World, there's so many stories about him having like these difficult collaborations with Penelope Spheeris, with Dana Carvey, with Lorne Michaels, where all of them were like kind of fighting for like that final word. And I think him having that experience and seeing like how Penelope Spheeris was able to like really cinematically enhance his entire script and like enhance the script and bring it to like a greater cinematic level, he was able to like become a more collaborative person. Because you read this script and see the film, there's like a huge difference to like how, in a word that I probably does not mean what I want it to mean, how much Jay Roach makes it more subtle. Yeah. The script is. I don't know if anyone's ever described Austin Powers as subtle or nuanced, but he's able to like bring so much style. And there's this quote that Jay Roach had when he was with this movie, was like, he said, "Who said style couldn't be funny?" And that's like so much like what this movie is just like making something incredibly stylish, and a lot of the comedy just being from how exciting this movie looks and how it can kind of like lay jokes in a way that are a little bit more character based or more pastiche based, rather than like how overtly like popular culture referency they are in this final draft version even.
I'll read the character introduction for Austin Powers, 'cause I think it's always interesting to hear how a script introduces the protagonist. We pan up to reveal Austin Powers, international man of mystery. He's a swinger with medium-length mod hair and sideburns and wears National Health Service glasses. Austin walks along Carnaby Street taking photographs. It's that perpetual bright sunny day you see in 60s movies. Austin, bursting with life, gives a two-handed handshake to a mod freak who's just gotten off a red double-decker bus. Austin salutes a strolling Bobby, then comes across two beautiful mod girls who are excited to see him. They all start to twist to the music, including the Bobby. Great introduction. And also, that is basically how it ends up on screen.
Yeah, it is pretty close. And, I mean, it's great. That's kind of all you need. But then there's a lot more in this opening sequence for him now, including him kneeing a blind man in the balls.
Is that because it wasn't expressly clear, but in the script, it hints that that's actually an undercover bad guy? Because doesn't he, like, he beats up, like, in the script, he's running from the girls, and then he beats up two bad guys.
Oh, yeah, maybe then, I missed that. Joke didn't land for me at all.
Yeah, because he's blind, but then he flicks the coin, and then the guy catches it.
He goes, no, and then knees him in the balls.
Kicks him in the balls.
And there's also a couple of moments here, probably three or four, where Austin says a joke, and then written into the big print is all the characters laugh, or they both laugh.
So the audience knows it's funny. And
it's the applause sign.
Yeah, and that's something that Alexi and I really spent quite a bit of time pondering, is that the most common comedy character you see, and one that I think is genius, sort of like Alan Partridge, a lot of the characters Steve Martin plays, or, you know, any of these kind of famous comedy characters are not funny in the world of the movie. Peter Sellers, his characters are never funny. He's sort of the buffoon that people make faces at or turn away or shake their head or whatever. But Austin, on the other hand, kills within the world. Everything he says gets a big laugh. Everyone loves him. Everywhere he goes, he's a genius. And I think that's so bizarre and rare, and I love to see it written into the script.
I wrote that down, that Austin does, he tries to make people laugh. He does funny things to be funny.
Yeah.
Like later on, there's the whole canoe and the elevator.
He does bits.
Thing.
Yeah.
I noticed that as well.
Kia, could I ask, do you think as well, like reading this, it seems so more overtly like a parody of stuff like Save the Cat, where within like the first few pages, you do all the tricks to make your protagonist likable.
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously the Basil Exposition character is the most obvious one, but just sort of playing on the rules of screenwriting and like trying to bury the setup. But instead, he's got this character who walks right in and tells Austin Powers a bunch of stuff that Austin already knows. And Austin says, "I know that." And he's like, "No, I just wanted to make sure that everyone is on the same page and it's clear." Like, that's genius. I love that stuff.
It's weird to see how much like Basil Exposition is toned down in the movie, because the overt joke that he is Basil Exposition, the guy that spills the exposition over and over and explains everything in the script, is so overdone, and I almost miss it because I think it's done so well. It's so funny on the page.
I agree. I think it's funnier on the page than in the movie. I think that was probably a bad cut in my mind. There's a lot of stuff that they could have got rid of that I would have been fine with, but I think it's a shame that some of that dialogue got chopped.
Speaking of the cuts, Kia, did we get cover off all the all everything you thought was a smart cut from the first 10 pages? Or were there any others?
No, I mean, I think everything that was lost, I think, was, yeah, it's a much tighter, funnier sequence because of all of those cuts, I think. There was nothing in there that I was like, that's a shame, other than the Basil exposition stuff. It's, yeah, I think Jay Roach made all the right calls.
Oh, actually, there's a moment in here I noticed that got reused in one of the sequels. Oh. When he's trying to make the Buckingham Palace guard laugh. Doesn't that get used in The Spy Who Shagged Me? Him and Felicity Shagwell do that. They try to
montages.
Make the guard laugh.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that's, yeah, that's kind of a reused gag that he tries later on in life, which I thought, you know, good to see him hanging on to his stuff.
Yeah, I think it's one of those like weird little fun little interstitial moments in between scenes.
Mm, that's right. Yeah, he's trying to make him laugh and then he kisses the guard on the cheek and the guard looks at him and smiles or winks or something.
And he likes it.
He likes it.
He likes it. He liked to be kissed by Austin.
Yeah, he didn't like to be kissed by Felicity, but when Austin did it, he did become horny, which does happen.
Yeah. Mm. And it just...
That's the guy.
And it shows that superpower that Austin Powers has where he...
That mojo power.
Yeah, he elicits horny from even the most unsuspecting sources.
All right, let's move on to the next 10 pages. So you hook the reader with the first 10. What are the next pages that you hand over to go, well, look, that should get you hooked, but here's what will really drive it home. This can be a group of pages. It can be one page. It can be one paragraph. It can be one sentence, one piece of dialogue. Alexi?
I think it is exactly like 4 pages after this where it kind of sells like the modern tone of comedy that this goes for, which is like when Austin Powers is being unfrozen in 1997. And it is one of the most like modern pieces of like playing with comedic timing that there is in Austin Powers, which is the evacuation complete sequence where Austin Powers is peeing for an unreasonably long amount of time. And it keeps on stretching out and stretching out. And I think that that sequence almost takes up an entire page describing this sequence in the film. And I think that is a moment in the film and in the script that like uniquely sells what is this weird sense of humor that Mike Myers is bringing to cinema in 1997. And I think to me, I'm like, that's a sell. If they push that in the first 10, that might get the exec on board rather than showing that Forrest Gump exists within Austin Powers.
What if I told you toilet humor and plenty of it? Would that be a good
Did you see the whole extended rake sequence in that episode of The Simpsons? Remember how funny that was? We've got our version of that. What about you, Cameron?
I've gone on record in the past of saying my favourite moment in this film, I can't remember where it sits in the screenplay, is the moment where Vanessa's drunk and she's asking Austin what her mother was like in the 60s. Yeah. And he gives this really quite genuine and earnest monologue about how she was amazing and her father loved her very much. And the only person who might have loved her as much as her father was him, but it was never meant to be between them. I think that's amazing. I love that moment. But the other one that jumped out at me when I was reading through this today is... I mean, it's kind of in the same vein. For some reason, it's the earnest things that grabbed me on this read, which is when Vanessa calls her mother, Mrs. Kensington, and they're talking and they're catching up a little bit about Austin, and Mrs. Kensington gives her own little discussion of what he was like, where she says, Austin is very charming, very debonair, he's handsome. And then she goes, did you ever... And Mrs. Kensington goes, no, of course. And there's sort of like a little moment there of maybe they did, maybe they didn't hook up. I never really noticed that moment in the million times that I've watched it. But I like that there's a subtle little C or D story here that Mrs. Kensington and Austin may have been... like held a candle for each other back in the past and it never got... It was unrequited. I find that so... I can't believe I'm going to say this, but beautiful.
Cameron, you're crying.
You might have been... You might have been distracted by the nude physical comedy going on in the background.
I think might have been.
You don't get that on the page.
Yeah, it doesn't even. I believe it is.
It is when Austin's doing. He's doing crunches, and she has the magnifying glass zooming in on his what should be his member.
Yeah. I'm just reading the big print on that exact Mrs. Kensington monologue now, and it's we hear the toilet flush in the background. Austin re-enters naked. Vanessa.
Oh, they really punch that up for the.
Vanessa moves the magazine in perfect timing, blocking the crotch from the camera. Yeah, I just didn't. I didn't read that big print, but yeah, you're right.
You actually.
Well, that's the power of reading the screenplay. Yeah. You just the words have without the distractions of actors and sets can be more powerful.
That's true. That's true. It's a drama for these few pages. Until you read the big print and realize that Austin Powers is naked and doing crunches in the background.
I actually think that's another, in the first 10 pages, another improvement in the final product is in the script, when we first meet Mrs. Kensington in the Shagwar, they immediately go, oh, we've got a call from Basil. But in the film, you do have like a nice few exchanges between Austin and Mrs. Kensington, like building that first bit of rapport, that first bit of playful relationship that they have as like kind of colleagues and also equals.
Yeah, that's right.
True.
That's right.
You get a slight bit of background.
Yeah, she's the one woman that won't give him what he wants. He's like, why won't you ever model for me? And she's like, because Mr. Kensington, she's a monogamist, and that is what he needs to learn to become.
That is true. You're exactly right. That's so true.
Is to be monogamous.
He's envious of Mr. Kensington right from the beginning, and then he becomes monogamous by the end. There we go.
And I want to talk about Mr. Kensington a bit later.
Yeah, and he becomes monogamous. He closes a circle by absolutely fucking and then committing to her daughter.
Yeah. Which is beautiful in a
way. It's a sweet story. What about you?
And in the ultimate showdown, he has to resist a group of women throwing themselves at him. That is a great. It's like, have you really changed? Have you really evolved as a character? And
he has.
Till the sequel.
Kia, what about your next 10?
So two sprang to mind for me. The first scene of Dr. Evil in 1997 is, it's an extremely long scene, but it is just so jam-packed with sort of joke runners. There's sort of several sequences of jokes in that one scene, which are so good. It kind of, you get Mustafa not quite dying after he's flipped back into the fiery pits. And then, you know, he can't quite be offed. Amazing. And then it goes into number two, listing all of their assets, you know, and showing them as these tiny miniatures on the board, and ending with, we also own a factory that makes miniature models.
Such a great joke.
Which is
that's
just
great.
Brilliant. And then you get the sequence of Dr. Evil outlining his plans to take over the world, only to discover that those things have happened in the 30 years in which he's been frozen, like framing Prince Charles as having an affair so that he can blackmail the royal family, and punching a hole in the ozone layer, which is so good that humans just fucked it up with
that. Yeah, and that gives way to one of the most quotable moments, the $1 million.
Yeah.
As the demand.
Yes, by the way, that moment is, in my opinion, the moment that you would cut out, and that would be a sketch on Saturday Night Live, which is evil billionaire from the 60s who's been, you know, thawed out or brought to the present, and every idea he has for world domination is has already been done. I think that would be the SNL sketch version of this.
Inspiration. It was an SNL sketch with a series of James Bond villains complaining about being unable to kill James Bond, and it feels like this sequence is sort of the evolution of that sketch.
Slight tangent. I know that on the first episode of Mic Check, you guys did the Best of Mike Myers SNL. I remember that was one of the first VHSs I ever owned. I got it as an ex-rental at Video Easy, and then followed it up with the Bad Boys of SNL.
Best
of Adam Sandler.
Farley, Spade, Rock, Sandler.
And me and my brothers, we still, when I'm back home, we still will just out of nowhere just go, Lothar, Of the of hill, the hill people.
Of the hill people.
I love
that. Just famously
that.
One of our least favorite sketches.
Oh, it's so unfunny.
But it's got a great theme song.
It goes for so long. It goes for so long. Where, what's the hyper, Philip the Hyper Hypo Kid fans. We're big fans.
Yeah. Great. I love that.
And the there's a great
and
movie sketch with the
Simon the Bath Boy.
Oh, yeah, that one's good.
Oh,
yeah.
Mickey That's Rooney. Incredible. I was the number one star.
In the world.
Yeah, amazing.
Must mentionables. You can't talk about Austin Powers without mentioning what? Cameron, I'll go to you first.
I mean, this is outrageous, but probably horniness. I think horniness will come up at some point. But for me, it's probably the male symbol necklace. I think that was the first time I became aware of the male symbol. And I remember wanting a male symbol necklace when I was in 1997, however old I would have been. Nine? Nine, I'm wanting
you
a male symbol necklace.
Yeah, I think display that, your male mojo.
Yeah, 9 years old is my guess.
Yeah, I don't want one anymore.
You've got the tattoo now, you don't need it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Which is incredible. Cameron, I must say, this is a bit of happenstance. You were nine in 1997, and guess how old I was?
Oh,
I was
wow.
6 years old, which is why forming one of the most horny numbers that anyone could possibly imagine.
15.
Yes, the time where a young man finally begins to feel horny.
Alexi, what about you? Must mentionables?
I got to give a huge, huge explicit shout out to the incredible Dr. Evil monologue in the with Carrie Fisher in the
movie. I wish I said this.
It is like the funniest scene ever, where he's talking about his childhood, and Carrie Fisher gives such a magnificent performance against like one of the most insane comedic characters of all time, where she like really hones in and is like, and what do you mean by taking over, you want him to take over the entire world when you die? And I think that it's just everything from like my father claimed that he invented the quotation marks, everything is so
my
good.
Father would womanize, he would drink. Every drink. Moment of that.
He would drink.
It's incredible, it's so
wonderful
funny.
Delivery.
Really a highlight.
My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with webbed feet. My father would womanize, he would drink. He would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy, the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament. My childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon, luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. When I was insolent, I was placed in a burlap bag and beaten with reeds. Pretty standard, really. At the age of 12, I received my first scribe. At the age of 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. There really is nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I suggest you try it.
You know, we have to stop.
That's Mike Myers' whole style, though. His writing style, when he's really let loose, is verbose, crazy references and talking about Europe and shorn scrotums. Like, that's him. It's just this crazy deluge of fucking nonsense. And I love it. And there was a tweet that went around a couple of weeks ago of a woman doing a dramatic reading of it. It holds up
Amazing.
As a dramatic reading.
Sublime.
It's really good.
It was sublime. We are going to audition at night with that one, Cameron and I. We're going to do it as a duologue. And we are going to try and become the next Joel Edgerton to combine.
Because Joel Edgerton is two people.
Yeah.
Are you going to do it one line at a time?
Or exquisite corpse
Trade
style.
It off.
Just one.
Well, one person does an interpretive dance version of it whilst the other person reads the lines.
One other thing that I'd like to mention, because this is a new discovery for me, so this is an exclusive for you guys. This has never appeared on the numerous times Cameron and I have talked about Austin Powers on Mic Check. I watched a movie just last week, which like was basically unlocking an entire like unknown strand of Austin Powers' DNA that I'd never seen before. It's a 1960s Italian movie by Mario Bava, based on like these weird like Italian and French comic books called Danger Diabolic, and it stars John Philip Law, the actor, as this character called Danger Diabolic, who is literally in the movie described the only other time I've heard it as an international man of mystery. And it's like very much in the same style of as Austin Powers. It does feel like those 1960s Batman movies as well, but it's like a little bit more serious. And it's kind of got like, it's kind of set maybe in the future. So everyone's wearing like those future designed costumes that that Dr. Evil implements and makes Austin and Vanessa wear at the end of the movie when he's got them captive. And the style of it is so in that same tone as Austin Powers, like so visually of that same aesthetic that I'd never even heard of it before. And watching it now, I'm like, this has to have been what Jay Roach saw, was this weird Mario Bava movie, and bring that to Austin Powers to kind of like elevate the style of it all and make it feel like a specific reference to a movie that people don't even know exists. But it's also that Beastie Boys video clip is literally taken from this movie as well. Good Lord, I don't remember which one it is, but that Beastie Boys.
Intergalactic.
Yes.
Planetary, is that what it's called?
Yes, really? I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
So does that mean Austin Powers could qualify then for an episode of Total Reboot if it's a stylistic reboot of this obscure 60s Italian movie?
Yeah, it might be.
There you go. Another excuse to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, cross promo for our long stagnant podcast that comes back every couple of months.
Some more must mentionables. This was Will Ferrell's first film role. There was another movie that came out this year that no one's ever heard of, so I'm just ignoring that one.
What was that? Was it Superstar?
No, he plays a photographer. It's really like, okay. I had never heard of it. I'm not even going to bother to look it up.
Yeah. It shall remain forgotten.
Also got to mention... Mindy Sterling as Frau Fabrissina.
Wow.
Just one of the one of the most underrated comedy performances in the whole series. I know you guys talked about that on your episode of Mic Check.
Amazing.
But you know how Quentin Tarantino revives the careers of like, you know, John Travolta? I feel like someone needs to do that for the comedy career of Mindy Sterling, because she is out there in the world, this unbelievable talent who hasn't been utilized to her full effect.
God, she's so funny in this. It's a powerhouse of a performance. And in all the sequels as well, you know, she's a highlight for sure. The love scene between her and Dr. Evil in Spy Who Shagged Me is like, it's a straight up comedy, like Oscar nominated comedy performance. It should be. If we're giving Oscar noms to Melissa McCarthy, we got to give one to Mindy Sterling.
Everything she brings to this performance is so good. Like how scary Frau is, how that she kind of has like this kind of softness, this heart beneath all of it. And just even if it was just the exact line readings that she gives, it's just one of the funniest, best comedy performances of all time.
Kia, how about you? Must mentionables.
One thing I wanted to point out was that the very opening line of the screenplay is a gag, and you so rarely see that. And I think that's amazing to put that in front of someone and be like, this is a comedy. It opens with superimposed title Somewhere Over Nevada with the extremely recognizable skyline of Las Vegas. And I just think that's so good to open with a straight up sight gag.
Oh, I'm an idiot. That went over my head.
And also, that's not in the movie. They've moved it to the desert for that opening.
It's
that rock formation that's in everything.
I was just going to say, the other thing that leapt out at me when I rewatched the film was that every bit part in this movie is it's a roster of Seinfeld bit players. I spotted at least like seven of them. It was crazy.
Oh, they're all, Soup Nazi.
They're all from Seinfeld.
Patrick Bristow, the wig master. He plays the tour guide in Voltron. Right. And I interviewed him on Mic Check because he was in town for like a week doing teaching improv classes. So I just sent him a weird out of the blue email saying,
fantastic.
Can I please interview you for this very specific podcast?
That's so great.
Good. Was he entertaining? Was he?
He's awesome.
Did he bring anecdotes?
He was legendary. He brought more than you would expect. It was so good.
There's also the guy who plays the soup Nazi. There's the very bad man guy. Can't remember any of the actual character names.
Babu Butt.
Babu.
Butt from
Babu.
Some other most mentionables. This is a dark one, but I don't know if you've ever Googled what became of the man who played Random Task in real life.
Yeah.
Best left unsaid if you're interested. Yeah, not great. Look it up, but he's in jail and will never get out.
I thought you were going to bring up Robert Wagner, number two.
What about Robert Wagner?
Google it.
Okay, that's another one you need to Google.
Yeah, tragically, he's not a great guy. Yeah.
Good stuff.
This has probably got the most murderers per capita for one of the most beloved and silly comedy movies around.
It's a murderer's row of comedians and then a murderer's row of murderers in this film.
The Fembots. We've got to mention the Fembots because they were a big takeaway at the time. Really played into the horniness of the movie. And I do love rewatching it this time, that how Austin Powers combats them is just with his sheer sexuality overwhelms robots. They cannot resist getting, even though they're robots, they can't resist getting horny when Austin Powers does his little dance and their head explodes. That is just when you think about it more, it's more ridiculous and more funny. Also, I got to mentioned the beginning of The Spy Who Shagged Me. This is just a bugbear for me. I hate when sequels undermine the events of the previous film.
Yes.
It really just says the start, even though they go so over the top, it plays into the world of Austin Powers. It just makes the entire journey of the first one irrelevant.
It always frustrated me as well. But on the recent rewatches, I've been able to get past that and enjoy it because it's so over the top, you know. And to have Basil Exposition say, sadly, we knew all along, is so funny.
It's so dumb.
As much as I love, I adore Liz Hurley's performance as Vanessa, and I love that character. Like Cameron said, it's like the best part of the movie is that she grounds this film. If it wasn't so funny the way that they do it, I would be really upset by it. But it is so funny that it's like the most crushing thing. And then immediately Austin's like, well, you know what? Hang on. That means I'm single again. And then have an entire naked dance.
Celebrate.
Busby Berkeley style naked dance sequence.
It plays into the Bond tradition of just completely disposable female love interests who come and go. But the worst example of it recently, I don't know if you saw that recent Terminator sequel. Yeah. Where they just made the events of the greatest Terminator movie, Terminator 2, just not amount to anything. Yep. That was a terrible
spoiler alert. But they shoot John Connor in the face 30 seconds into the movie, and then Linda Hamilton turns to the camera and goes, "Hang on a tick, I'm not a mother anymore," and does a dance sequence.
Okay, so when this is a question for you all. When Dr. Evil wants to prove to Scott that he's with it and hip, he does the Macarena because it's 1997. What would the 2020 version of showing you're with it be if this movie came out this year?
Oh, fuck.
Would it be a TikTok dance?
He would dab. He'd dab for sure. Or do the backpacking dance for 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he would do the Fleetwood Mac TikTok with the cranberry juice.
Gosh.
That would be it.
I mean, it would require some props.
There would be TikTok jokes in it if it was made now.
Or just show Scott his OnlyFans account. I'm with it. I have an OnlyFans.
I'm on OnlyFans, yo. It would be something like that.
Okay.
Subscribe, yo. He'd say something like that.
Cameron, I know you've got to get to puppy preschool, which is adorable. So we do have to wrap up.
I'm going to graduate.
Do you have another couple of minutes, or do you need to
Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course.
Well, I just want to do noted to death. And this is just basically anything that stands out that if you were an executive, you'd say, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up. I'll kick it off.
Someone else go
Dr. first. Dr. Evil's plan in the first 10 pages is to trap Austin Powers at this nightclub. And then at the first sign of trouble, he bails and freezes himself. It's a pretty low bar of...
Doesn't hold water.
He doesn't try anything else. He immediately freezes himself for 30 years.
One thing that always annoys me structurally about this film is, like, you get to the end and then you get your, you know, what is supposed to be just your hook scene that sets you up for a potential sequel. But instead, Random Task, rather, comes back for another fight scene, and it just, like, ruins the momentum of the whole thing. It's like, it's wrapping up, we've reached the climax, and then there's just this extra fight scene. It really
irritates
me. But
then you get the gag of who throws a shoe. You wouldn't get that otherwise. But maybe you were riding on it, Peter would say, let's move that who throws a shoe gag to page 45 when we first meet him.
But I don't know how else you're going to bring back the one of the most extravagant pieces of prop mastery in film history. The Swedish Maid penis enlarger makes a glorious comeback in that last scene when he uses it to kill Random Task by, I guess, extracting all the blood from the rest of his body into his penis.
Which also doesn't make sense that Austin Powers would be embarrassed by it if he's literally written a book.
That's one of my favorite gags. I would put that in the next 10 pages, actually, if we can go back and insert that. That's such a funny gag.
That's not so my bag, baby. A book. Okay, well, all right then. I want to mention poor Papa Kensington here. Just tracking, you know, the events of that Austin Powers must be his mortal enemy. Because back in the 60s, he knows his wife is working with this highly desirable man who is pursuing her actively. Then 30 years later, he goes away, thinks, phew, done with Austin Powers. He comes back and his daughter falls in love with him.
Wow.
Only to then find out somewhere along the line, his daughter was murdered and replaced by a robot.
That's not good.
Poor
Mr. Kensington.
I have been ages trying to think of Austin Powers 4. And I think this is it. And then you get Dana Carvey to play him doing his David Niven impression.
Do you know what, though? It's not a movie, Alexi. It's a series. It's a series on the WB. It's called Kensington. Mm-hmm. And it's just a gritty origin story all about what happens between 1967 and 1997 to the Kensingtons.
Tweet this out to Mike Myers immediately. There's something in it.
He's not on Twitter, and it drives me crazy because I reckon we would have been able to meet him by now, but he's not on socials.
Oh, man.
You got to go to Hawaii and hang out with him and his manager.
Yeah.
Track him down. Shep down.
Track Shep. Finding Shep.
Finding
that's the next
Ubermensch.
One. I think he's dead, unfortunately. I think Shep died.
I think he died right around the time of the movie.
Sorry.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
I think... I don't know whether this is, you know, something that... It falls under the noted to death category, but I do feel like this film would obviously be noted to death in 2020 for Austin's sort of campaign of sexual harassment of Vanessa through the first half of the movie. But I think there's something quite interesting in it. There's several things in this script where it's like Mike Myers could see the writing on the wall of what was coming, and Mrs. Kensington even says to her daughter at one point, you can't judge him by modern standards. He's very much a product of his times. Yeah. And there is a whole scene that got cut out of the script very wisely in which Austin learns a series of words that he can no longer say in 1997 that he could that he was allowed to say in that
oh god, that would have been hilarious.
I think there would be some notes in 2020 around some of the politics in Austin Powers.
Add that to the smart cuts. All right, Alexi Taliopoulos, Cameron James, hosts of Finding Drago and now Finding Desperado, available where you get your podcasts. Have a listen.
Thanks
you will
so
not
much.
Regret it. Thanks for being on the show, guys, and discussing the masterpiece that is Austin
Thank
Powers.
You. thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to dive back into one of our favorite flicks that we are too scared to talk to each other about anymore because we spent over 70 hours discussing it with each other.
How long had it been since you'd watched it?
Over a year?
Yeah, for me.
No, probably not over a year.
It had been a while for me.
I think I revisit every 6 months at least.
This is like maybe my favorite movie, but I don't watch it very much anymore because it tragically it's become like work now to watch Austin Powers. I don't watch it for joy anymore.
You can't turn off the critical part of your brain and the make note of that for a take in the podcast and observation.
Yeah, but then
like
all my notes.
Some people watch Kubrick.
Yeah, all my notes are just actually very funny.
That gag holds up.
Yeah, very funny.
There you are.
Yeah.
Do I know you? No, but that's where you are.
That's my favorite part.
I love
the movie.
That part.
Cameron knows.
That's my favorite. Yeah. That's my favorite gag. Yeah.
That is something that you could do in real life that would endear you to strangers, or get you punched in the face.
Definitely.
One or the other. Hey, Kia. Thanks again.
No worries. Thank you.
If you enjoy this show, please give it a review wherever you get your podcast from. The first 10 pages really helps, so we appreciate it. Contact us at the first 10 pod. That's TEN pod. We're on Twitter and Instagram. All right, that's it. We'll see you next time. Fade to black. The end.